Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs for an audience of entrepreneurs. I am so happy about today's guest because he's someone who listened to these interviews just like you. And I was going to say you're a hustler, Andrew, but I don't think that's what it is. You know what amazes me about you? It's you learning to code, you putting in the work before the sun came up, before your family woke up. It's you, I picture, on the train with, what was it? You had a laptop with you?
Oh, gosh, yeah. That was a long time ago. And I remember those early days. It was I at the beginning. I had to literally write this product on my commute or before work because I had a job. You know, I had to earn an income. And as I wrote in the blog post you read, you know, in the early days, I would get up very early. I'm not a morning person. I would wake up at, say, 5:30, set an alarm, and then try and set aside a few hours a day to create this product. And then because I live outside of London, you know, a good 40, 50 minutes on the train, I had this laptop. And this was like an old Beta sort of, I can't remember the brand. You know, it's nothing flash like a nice MacBook. It got bashed around a lot on the train, but I was sitting there coding while people are like reading the paper or looking at their phones or whatever. Yeah, build the product like that, you know?
I can't believe you could focus with all that going on. I can't believe you could get yourself to be up that early, be focused at home, and then spend the whole day working on your business, working at your job, being with the family, and then, you know, giving up the next day or giving in to fatigue. Let me introduce him. Today's guest is Andrew Burnett Thompson. He is the founder of SciChart. You know how a lot of software has charts in it? I always assume that the software makers created the charts too because it's just a chart. Turns out it's not just a chart. It's a way of analyzing lots of data fast and making it look presentable to people. So many developers, whether it's for their own software that they use internally or software that they create for customers, don't do it themselves. They just pay Andrew's company, SciChart, to create the charts, to give them the charting software. That's what this business is. Am I right?
Yeah, Andrew? Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, a lot of software nowadays is sort of, you don't write everything from scratch. If you're building an application, there's so much out there now. There's a huge open source movement. Almost every piece of software uses open source now. So that's free stuff that's been made by developers just for sort of love or, you know, recognition. But ours is commercial. And you're absolutely right. That if you wanted to put a chart into your application, doesn't matter what it is, maybe it's a fitness app, maybe it's a business dashboard, maybe it's a trading or financial application, you know, your first job is going to be to find something that can do that. And your choices are to use something out there that's free or to build it yourself or to use a commercial one like our own that we've made at SciChart. And it's an incredible amount of work. I mean, you said it's just a chart. And this is possibly the hardest thing that we have in our sort of sales and marketing. We have 3.5 million lines of code in our chart software. So that just a chart, it took us 8 years of R&D to get to where we are now. And it's incredibly complex under the surface, but you're right that we make it look simple.
And the other thing that it sounds simple is, it seems like, well, he's a developer. He could do it. Developers can do it. No, he wasn't a developer. Self-taught before there were really online programs to teach people. We're going to find out how he built up this company, how he bootstrapped it, where the revenue is today. And I think you're going to be very impressed with how far he has come with this company. And we can do it thanks to two phenomenal companies, two phenomenal sponsors. The first, if you need to hire a developer, really a great, phenomenal developer, someone who's done the work that you need, done it already, rocked it, and can do it for you, go to toptal.com/Mixergy. And the second, as you're listening to the story, notice how he got his first customers, Andrew did, by blogging. And then they started saying, when is this software going to be available? If you're ready to start to think about a product, even start blogging about it, start talking about it. And if you need a way to do that, do what Andrew did. He started with WordPress. I'll tell you later why you should get your WordPress site hosted on hostgator.com/Mixergy. Andrew, do you feel comfortable telling us where your revenues were last year, 2019?
I can tell you where they are now. I mean, we're on course to make about $2 million annual revenue. We're on track to grow 30% this year, year on year, okay, in sales. And yeah, last year, I mean, I think about 1.5 million, like that's where you get your 30% from.
All bootstrap, right? No outside funding?
All bootstrap.
You yourself.
100% privately owned. We didn't have any capital or anything to begin with, nothing.
Let's go back and understand this though, because you graduated with a degree in what back in 2003?
I had electronic and electrical engineering. I was really into building circuits when I was young, absolutely loved it. And, you know, I went to university in 1999. And at that time in the 90s, it, you know, electronics was the big thing. You know, if you did this, you would work for a really cool company like, I don't know, NASA or something, and you were guaranteed a job. And I went into it and I did my 4-year degree. I came out with a master's degree and I couldn't get a job at the end of that degree because the dot-com bubble had just burst. And all these jobs, there were like loads, thousands before I went into university. They kind of evaporated. You know, I remember sending 40 job applications when I graduated, getting 2 interviews and flunking both of them in rather tragic circumstances. So, you know, I had a bit of a dilemma. What do I do?
What's the tragic circumstance? Give me one.
Well, comedic circumstances. So the first interview I went to, I was so broke that I had to borrow £20 from my, like a friend to put fuel in my car and drive to this interview. And it was a 3-hour drive. And I left super early because I didn't want to be late. And I was driving down in this old beat up car and there was an accident on the motorway. They closed all 3 lanes of the motorway for 3 hours. I mean, this is unprecedented. So I turned up hours late, flustered, you know, obviously stressed out. I flunked that interview. It was terrible. Didn't get the job. So the next one, I thought to myself, do you know what? I'm not going to drive. I'm going to take the train because I don't want anything like what happened before. And, you know, my wife, who was my fiance at the time, you know, gave me some money to buy a train ticket. They're quite expensive over here in the UK, £50 to get to London. And I went down on the train and I kid you not, the train stops and it's there stopped for ages. And it comes over the tannoy. What happened? They said the train hit a cow.
Well,
the train hit a cow. And I couldn't believe it. And you know, I texted my wife. I had one of those old Nokia flip phones. Do you remember those?
Yeah. Like
with the buttons before the screens and whatnot that you have now.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, you know, honey, I'm going to be late to the interview.
So no job. It didn't work out. What did you do? Did you go back to school? Did you do something else?
Yeah, well, I flunked that second interview as well. And I'll be honest with you, it wasn't a great job. I mean, it exposed to me like how much people were being paid as graduates and what bad conditions. I won't tell you who it was, but you know, I just thought this is shocking, really. I'm glad I didn't get it. So I ended up going back to university and the university said, look, you know, you're really good at what you do. If you want to come here and, you know, build for us, we will sponsor you to do a PhD, a doctorate.
Okay.
And it wasn't what I wanted to do. It wasn't on my plan. I had planned to go into business, you know, the big city, blah, blah, blah. But I took it because they were paying and they weren't paying a huge amount of money, but it was enough. So during that 3 years at university, I thought to myself, okay, I'm trained in electronics, but there's no jobs. So what is there? So I remember going on search engines and typing in, you know, C++ jobs, programming jobs. And there were hundreds, like within miles of my house, not countrywide or nationwide. They were local, hundreds of jobs.
Where were you? Where were you living?
I was living in Manchester at the time, which is in the north of England, okay. A couple of hundred miles north of London. But programming and software, it was obvious that it was boom business. And that was in 2003. So I thought to myself, do you know what? I got to learn. I need to learn this. So I just completed a degree. I just done all of that stuff. And what I did this further study, but I kind of had the freedom to direct it a little bit. So I directed it towards, I'm going to do as much software as I can, you know? So yeah, okay. I began the process of learning.
What's this? What's the Sam's Teach Yourself books? I looked them up. I didn't know about them before.
Yeah. I mean, those are quite old books. You know, we're talking like 15, almost 20 years old. And, you know, I gave those as an example of how I learned. Because nowadays, if you want to learn to program, you've got so many resources. You know, you have YouTube, you've got websites like Pluralsight, Udemy, PacketPub. There's tutorials everywhere. Courses, you can buy them. You can learn to code. You can do a boot camp. We didn't have any of that stuff. I mean, we barely had Google, you know, in 2003. So the Sam's books, they're very simple books. And, you know, They have 24 lessons, which you can do in an hour. And I sat down and I-
One hour per lesson.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay. And you just sit there and work through it. And I did, you know, and it took me about 3 or 4 books to realize what I wanted to do, you know, so it took me 3 or 4 months to say, okay, this isn't going to work for me. This is going to work for me, you know.
And are you the type of person who was regimented about it, who'd say, I want to every day do one lesson, 1 hour, not stop until I finish?
I'll be honest with you. I'm very disorganized and I'm not that kind of person, but I forced myself because I wanted the prize. What I wanted was employment. I wanted a good income. I wanted success. So, you know, I kind of forced myself. I have to do this. This is the way out. You know,
every day to do one.
Yeah. I mean, maybe not every day, but I was pretty consistent. Yeah.
How did you live though? If you needed money from your wife to get a train,
That was when I was a student, but by this time I was actually doing a PhD at the university and they were paying me a small amount, not a huge amount of money, but they were paying me enough to pay bills and whatnot.
Okay. And then in your spare time, you said, I'm also going to learn how to code.
Yeah. And I worked it into the study. So like a lot of the work I did in software, I had a choice. Do I build a circuit or do I write some code for it? And, you know, I chose to practice as much as I could while I was there. So by the end of that, you know, took 3 years to graduate a second time. By the end of that, I was pretty proficient at software, or so I thought. Good enough to get a job. And I did get a job straight out the gate. I sent one application, had one interview, and got the job straight away.
Wow. So, as opposed to 40 applications, yeah. 2 interviews, and 2 failures.
Yeah, as opposed to totally flunking. Yeah, it was a different story.
You know, this is what was hot. People didn't want a lot of electrical engineers, but they needed desperately software developers.
And that trend is still going on today. I mean, you know, right now in 2020, there's this whole movement of learn to code and people are wising up and waking up to, oh my goodness, you can, you know, 6-figure salary is not out of the question as a software engineer, even with say, you know, 3 years experience or 4 years experience. If you're good at your job, you can earn very, very well because software transcends every industry. Every single industry needs it. You know, they're all using it.
But I don't even realize how much software has transcended, has embedded itself in everything. You're going to tell us later on about how Formula One is one of your customers. I wouldn't have thought that the pit crew at Formula One races would need software, let alone the right charting software. And once you hear that, you see it is embedded everywhere. You know, let me take a moment, talk about my first sponsor since we're talking about developers, and then come back in to the rest of the story. And I'm curious to see then, once you got a job, what that was like, and then what led you to say, all right, job is not enough. I have to go and develop my own thing, even though I've got so many other obligations. My first sponsor is a company called TopTal. I know you've heard of them for hiring developers. Let me ask you this. Since you haven't used TopTal yet, what tips do you have for either hiring remote developers, which is what TopTal does, great developers, all remote, or for managing remote developers? Do you have one tip that we can pass to people within this commercial for TopTal?
Do you know what? I think that managing and hiring remote developers is very difficult unless you yourself understand software development. What we have found is rather than have an extensive interview process, we give people a technical test and then a face-to-face interview to determine attitude, personality, communication skills, et cetera, et cetera. By outsourcing that to an agency such as TopTal that you've mentioned, they're doing a lot of that legwork and hard work. They're already filtering through people who have the right kind of skills. So luckily I know what to look for, but somebody else, if they were not software oriented, I would absolutely say you want to be using experts to find the right talent.
You want to know something? We flew a guy, one of the top people at TopTal, to San Francisco, brought him into my office here to the conference room that's like a few walls behind me, sat him down. I said, let's record a masterclass for Mixergy about how to hire developers because you guys have done it so much. He says, I could talk, but TopTal won't let you publish. I said, I usually, if it's a course, we'll be flexible about whether we publish or not, but I don't understand why they wouldn't let us publish. Let's just talk. He said, I don't think they would allow it. I said, let's record it. If they say no, I'll just dump it out. He goes, okay. He says, they're not going to let us, but I'm happy to talk about this because I'm very proud of the system we built. He starts telling me about a process that they've created that's very similar to what you talked about, where they bring in people to do who who know the software, who are developers, who are top developers, to basically screen out developers. And they get these amazing, right? I'm incredibly hesitant here because I know how they do not want me to talk about their process in any way. But that's essentially a big part of what they do at TopTal, what you're describing. And then people get into their network. Meanwhile, of course, we messaged TopTal. They said, we created this great course. It's so good about how to hire. They said, don't run it. I said, but it's amazing. You have to understand people are going to read. They're going to listen to it. They're going to learn so much. I go, don't run it. All right. So we never got to run it, but that's essentially what they do at TopTal. They have a process for finding developers, for screening them out, and then making sure that they have phenomenal developers. And then they have a matcher who, when if you follow my URL that I'm about to give you, you will get to talk to the matcher. They'll understand you. They know their network of developers. They'll match you up. You can get started for a few hours, a full-time job with someone, or even a whole team of people who work on your project. Many people who I've interviewed will say, I have this thing that we need. I'm not going to hire someone to do it in case we don't want to continue. Like maybe they want charting. Maybe they'll hire someone to just do the charting thing and then say, actually, we shouldn't be doing it. We should be hiring an outside firm. But before they do, they want the best of the best of people to do the work for them. And so what they'll do is they'll go to TopTal, say, let's get someone who's going to build it on their own, won't distract our team, and then we'll decide whether we want to continue or not. All right. So whatever you need, if you want to talk to TopTal, all you have to do is go to toptal.com/mixergy and you'll get into a conversation with the matcher. Why throw the slash mixergy at the end? Because frankly, it helps me out. And I really appreciate you showing them that you've heard about TopTal from me, but also you will get 80 hours of developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours, in addition to a no risk period. All you have to do is go to top as in top of your head, tal as in talent. That's toptal.com/mixergy, toptal.com/mixergy. You got a job. Tell me about the good thing about the job before we get into why you decided that you needed to go and do this whole thing on your own.
Okay, well, I worked for that company, the first one I went to after university, for about 3 years. And it was a scientific software consultancy, and they worked with incredibly wide, varied sort of numbers of customers. Like they had customers in the nuclear industry. They had customers in like legal, medical, you know, oil and gas. There was even some stuff that we did for, believe it or not, you talked earlier about how you couldn't believe software was in everything. Yeah. I'm not going to tell you which company it was, but there's a very large company that makes things like shampoo and deodorant. You would not believe the research that goes into making those products. And they have laboratories and they have software and they have lab technicians and whatnot. They're doing experiments and they're writing their own applications to help do their experiments to prove that their products are better than their competitors.
So then what do you like about all this?
Well, I guess problem solving, first of all. I mean, you know, software is, you know, it's complex. It requires you to really, really understand what's happening. You get to build interesting things. You get to sort of do a lot of variety. Some of the projects I've done have been really, really cool, like controlling robots or, you know, processes in factories or things like that, you know. So I worked in that job for about 3 years, and I'll be honest with you, I thought I was all right. I thought I was quite good when I went into it, but I actually learned an awful lot just going through it, seeing other people. You have to earn your stripes. You know, in this industry, it's not something that you can go from zero to hero. You know, you have to spend time refining your craft, getting very, very good at it, learning all of the techniques. You know, and ultimately, you know, I got to a point where I was there from, say, 2006 to 2009. And during that time was a credit crunch. And, you know, credit crunch was pretty, it hit everybody pretty hard, right? You know, massive recession. People were losing their jobs left, right, and center. I didn't lose my job. No, you know, nobody at our company did. It was a very, very well-managed company. But I saw it, yeah? And I saw, you know, people unable to pay their mortgages, people unable to pay their bills. And I remember saying to my wife, I said, I really need to make other streams of income. I've got to, you know, do something that can earn money in not just British pound, our own currency, but it needs to earn in dollars. I want to earn in euros. I need to earn in, you know, from other countries, be more diversified so that if I lose a job or something bad happens, I can still pay my bills, you know? So that kind of leads into the phase of where I began starting to think about business, leveling up in my career, and so on and so forth.
I heard you were creating multiple products in your spare time, trying to teach yourself, but also figure out a business. Am I right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I've always been the kind of person who wanted to create something, you know, create a business of some kind, but I didn't know what. I mean, you know, I'm choosing software because you don't need any capital, right? I mean, okay, fine. If you hire people, you need capital. But if you have a good enough idea and you have enough skill and the idea is simple enough, you can build it yourself. All you need is a laptop, you know? And if you can start to get traction, you can then roll the funds that come in back into the application.
Right.
Whereas if you're making a, I don't know, widget, some kind of a device of some kind, you need millions in order to, you know, even get to a prototype stage.
Did you ever create a product on your own as an electric engineer? Did you do anything?
No. Unfortunately not. I mean, just tinkering in my spare time. But
would you tinker and create yourself?
Or a long time ago
or something?
A long time ago, I made, you know, little things like lighting circuits. And I actually made a mixing desk, you know, for DJing, believe it or not. That was a hobby of mine when I was about 18. I was rubbish at it. But I made things like that. But, you know, it's incredibly difficult to make a product on your own. You need, you know, labs, you need factories, you need capital to do it. Whereas software, you can create something.
So what are some of the things that you created in your spare time?
So I was very interested in finance and trading. What with the credit crunch, I saw how badly everything sort of crashed. I thought to myself, do you know what? Trading software is a really good area to be in. I was trying to make, you know, stuff like that, but I quickly hit two limits. And, you know, number one was my skill. And number two was, you know, it lacked critical components. There were some parts that would just take way too long to build. And one of those was the charts. So
you created software for finance that you couldn't create the chart for.
Yeah. So basically, I started off, I was in my spare time trying to create a business to make financial trading software. And I quickly realized that one, this is like a 10-year job or like a, you know, 3-4 year job for a team of 10. It's huge. And two, at the time, you know, this was back in 2010, say, there were no, you know, you talked about earlier how you can go and get a chart component and plug it in. There was none that was really good enough to do the real depth of all the features that you need for, you know, financial trading. So it hit this wall, and I kept trying to do this and kept hitting this wall. And eventually I kind of, you know, I had a very, very strong conviction, shall we say, I need to build the chart, you know, because if I'm failing to build this thing, which is too big for me to do anyway on my own, because of the chart, maybe other people are failing to build these kind of things too, you know? So yeah, that was about 2011. That's when I started creating this. And you know, I had a very strong conviction, as I said, to stop what I was doing and do the chart and do it now.
You know what? I'm looking at my notes here from 10 years ago. I interviewed Pallav Nadhani. He is the founder of Fusion Charts. He found a similar issue and he created it. So it existed by then, didn't it?
It did. But Fusion Charts, they specialize in charts for the web browsers, JavaScript, whereas what we specialize in is charts for Windows and mobile. And also a little niche that we looked at because, yeah, these kind of things existed. You know, don't get me wrong. There was maybe, you know, 5 or 10 other companies doing them already. But the niche that we looked at was high performance, big data, you know, complex visualizations, the kind of thing like not just sort of like a, I don't know, maybe a fitness app with a simple graph in it, but something really, really complex that a scientific customer might want to visualize. And that was the niche we concentrated on. And I mentioned in my blog post that I started blogging about the first version because I was trying to get something that could perform much better, much faster than anything else on the market, you know, maybe 10 times faster. That was a goal. And I started blogging about it and people started to contact me and say, hey, this is great. When's it going to be ready? You know, and I was like, I don't know. Looked to my wife. When's it going to be ready? She says, you tell me. Another guy sends me an email and I've only made a prototype and he emails me and he goes, this is exactly what we need. How much is it going to cost?
Wow.
You know, and this was a pharmaceutical company in America. And I said to them, oh, okay. How many people do you have on your team? And he goes, oh, we got 10 people on our team. So I'm like, well, how much? We didn't even know what to price it at. We didn't even have a plan.
You mean you and your wife?
Yeah, myself and my wife. Yeah. I mean, I interchangeably use we and I, because to begin with, it was just me, but she's been on the road with me the whole time. And now we have 15 people, you know, 15 staff. So now I say we naturally, but yeah, at the time it was just me.
You know what? I read that you had some criteria for what you wanted this new project to be. You've tried other things in the past. They didn't really go much and go far. One of them was, you said you have to be able to build it yourself, right?
Yep.
You didn't want to have outside people. It had to be done in under a year. I understand why under a year. Mm-hmm. It had to, there had to be a market there, and there had to be profitability early on, clear road to profitability, right?
Yeah.
Obviously nothing that took a lot of capital. You didn't have access to money. And so that was the criteria. You sat there and you said, if I need charts, then maybe other people do. I'm going to create the chart software that I wish existed for all the projects that I had. And then what I'm trying to understand is, why did you blog about it then?
Why did I blog about it?
Yeah, you mean blog? Like
to tip people off or you know, I mean, I had, as I said to you, or you just said, I had no capital. I had no clout, no connections. Do you know what I mean? So you can't just sell a product unless you have.
So this was marketing, letting people know what you had in mind as a way of recruiting people who cared about it. Okay. All right. Let's then move on to your schedule for getting this done. I kind of hinted at it. You woke up at what time since you had a full-time job?
I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Are you a morning person?
No, I absolutely hated it. I'm a night owl, but I, you know, I figured that after work, you know, it's very, very noisy in the house. You know, there's stuff going on. You know, we had a young son who's 11 years old now. At the time he was 2. So I thought, you know, morning is completely quiet. Nobody's about. It's a good time for focusing. I'm not a morning person. I hate it. So I would wake up at 5 or 5:30 if I couldn't do it. And I would try to get a solid, you know, 2, 2.5 hours, sometimes even 3 hours before I jumped on the train. And
Let me pause there. How did you get yourself as a night owl to wake up that early? What trick did you use on yourself?
Jedi mind trick. I guess, like I said, hunger. I didn't have any money. You know, I was living in a rented house. We'd previously just moved. We moved from Manchester to London. My wife had just given birth. You know, we had a young son. She'd lost her job as well in the credit crunch. So, you know, I was now the only earner. And I said, look, if we're going to earn enough money to buy a house, I've got to do something. So, you know, hunger. But practical tip, I mean, I guess what I did was I set an alarm and then I got up, forced myself to get up. And then I would set out my desk, you know, the night before. So I'd have a computer and a notepad, like, this is what you need to do in the morning. Because, you know, when you get up, your mind's foggy and whatnot. So, you know, make a coffee, I look at the notepad. Okay, I'm just going to do this one thing. I'm going to do this one thing. Do it, go to work, come back. And then, you know, in order to get up at that time, you need to go to bed early. So I would go to bed at like 9 o'clock, you know, which is pretty antisocial. But you know, I don't understand these people that wake up at 5 and they're still working at like, you know, midnight. I mean, that's not sustainable. So I would go to bed early, pretty boring. And I would do that. I did that for about 6 months, I think, before it became a little bit too much. And then I dialed it back, you know, a little bit later, and I would use the train more. Funnily enough, we started making money quite soon. So we used that money to hire, you know.
Let me still go through your early schedule. 5, you'd get up in the morning. Mm. You would start to work on your side project. I'm assuming kitchen table, right?
Dining, were you a dad at the time? Table. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So my son was, I think, 1 or 2. I can't remember exactly.
Okay. So he would sleep. Yeah. You'd be up at the table. You'd be working. Yep. You'd continue until 8 a.m. Then at 8 o'clock, you'd get on your train to London. We talked about how you were studying on the train. You were also in the 45-minute commute. Now that you had a business, you were coding on your laptop on the way to work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean,
and still able to focus.
Yeah, I mean, noise-canceling headphones go a long way, or earbuds if you can't, you know, if you don't have them, they go a long way. But I was just singularly focused on building this thing. I kind of knew what I needed to do. I had the skill to do it. Like I said, I didn't want to build something that I didn't know how to do. I didn't want to build something that was too big for me to do or too complex. So I chose this because I thought I can do this. This is where I have skills.
Put in a full day of work.
Yep.
I know this is so mundane, but I'm so freaking fascinated by it. You still put in a full day of work,
yeah.
Which obviously it's not easy work at a time when everyone's worried about losing their jobs. You have to show up, be as optimistic, positive, and hardworking as you could be, then get on the train back home, still doing coding, research, learning?
A little bit. I mean, that was pretty much the end of the day. So maybe there's a couple of emails to answer or something to look up or something quick to do, you know.
Okay.
But I get very, very bored if I sit on like a train or an airplane. I have to do something. You know, I'm not the kind of guy that can sit there.
What did you used to do before you had this side project?
To be honest with you, it wasn't, you know, I'd only been working in London, say, 6 months before I started it. So I didn't have long, but yeah, I would, I don't know, read the news or something, listen to music. Okay. I found it incredibly boring. I'd actually rather be building something than sitting there.
I'll close this out by saying you'd get home at 7 o'clock, you'd spend time with your wife and your son, and then you'd go to bed at 9 o'clock, like you said, and start the day over again. Work weekends also on this, or weekends were family?
Well, to begin with, it was pretty much evenings and weekends. It was solid, but you know, you can't do 7 days a week for a long period of time. You have to have some rest.
Are you saying weekends you were working solid?
Oh yeah, I was working on the weekends.
Your wife
as well.
Was with your son, and you were working most of the day on your side project.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, like I said, that was for a short period of time. It was a sprint.
Yep.
Once I got to the point where there was sort of like, you know, proof of concept, a prototype and whatnot, you know, I was able to dial it back a little bit. But, you know, I'm an all or nothing kind of person. I wouldn't recommend that level of work for a long period. I wouldn't recommend it for everybody. But there was certainly a time when I was working like 90 hour weeks. You know, it's crazy.
All right. Hunger really fueled you.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back and find out how you figured out what to charge the first customers, what that first version did for them. Did it fail? Did it work? And then that spectacular first year. I've got the number here of what you did the first year. But first, I'll tell everyone that my second sponsor is a company called HostGator. Andrew, you blogged. Any tips for people who are building a business and saying, you know what? I have this idea. I want to blog about it. Any tips for them on what they should do if they go to hostgator.com/Mixergy and get a hosting package?
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to blog about something, you need to be careful what you give away, right?
Because
if you have a great idea and you just, if that idea is easily repeatable and you start talking about it before you've finished it, someone's going to nick your idea or they might nick your
really?
Idea.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And we actually had that, by the way, that's a topic we could talk about, that the blogging, although it won us customers, it was marketing. We had no clout whatsoever. A competitor saw it and decided, you know, heck, they've managed to achieve this. We can do the same thing.
Okay.
So you need to be careful about what you give away, but maybe if you have a product that is in proof of concept, maybe it's ready for sale. Maybe it's, you know, a month away from sale, that kind of close, you know. Blogging, it gets the word out there. People, if there is a need for your product, they are Googling it. They're Googling for it. They're searching for it. You know what I mean?
Okay, that makes sense. All right, I'm going to suggest this. Even if you're not yet ready, if you don't know what your idea is, if you're just thinking out loud, it's better to think publicly than to think in your own little journal. We're not 6-year-old boys and girls, we're adults. Think publicly, not in your little diary, and see what comes up when you put it out there for the world to see if they react and say, I want to buy this. If they react and say, I've got this other idea, I have this other need. When you do that, then you start to draw people to you who will help you think through your business. God knows that's what happened to me with Mixergy. If you're out there and you want to start a website, go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. There are tons of hosting companies. I like them because they've been around for a long time. They're dependable. They're inexpensive. And you can get started with them. And then you'll see the price is super low. And as you grow, they have other plans that will grow with you. God knows Mixergy wasn't an appropriate fit for their cheapest plan. We were starting to get a lot of audience, big growth. We moved up. They have all these other plans. But I recommend that you get started with the inexpensive, very effective plan at hostgator.com/Mixergy. You'll get the lowest price they have possible when you follow that URL, hostgator.com/Mixergy. Let's talk about pricing. How'd you know what to charge?
You know what? I had no idea, in all honesty. I mean, it sounded outrageous for me to charge what we did charge. But what we did was, you know, the first version of our software, it was very, very basic, but it was very fast. So all it could draw was like line charts, you know, and a few other basic things like that. but it was very fast and it was beating the next fastest competitor by, you know, a factor of 10 kind of thing. And I looked at the market and I saw that, you know, some companies were charging like $300 for this kind of thing and some companies were charging $1,500. And I thought to myself, well, I'm new. I don't want to be $1,500. It's too high. So, and I don't want to be at the bottom end of that spectrum because, you know, people associate higher price with quality. So I went right in the middle. The first version of the software was about $799 or about £500 at the time. So we got that inquiry from the pharmaceutical company that said, how much is this going to cost for 10 people? And we said to them, you know, finger in the air, we had to just decide. And we came up with a pricing strategy or plan or structure that looked reasonable for the market. It was kind of in the middle of the road. And we said, $5,000, you know? And the guy emailed me back and goes, great, tell me when it's done. And I said to my wife, I remember, this guy said, great, tell me when it's done. I hadn't even finished it, right? And it was out there, it was a prototype, but it wasn't finished. You know, in terms of pricing, there was a book I read, a very interesting book called Predictably Irrational. It talks about the kind of decisions that people make and marketing and whatnot. And something that caught my eye was something called the decoy pricing strategy. Yeah. Have you heard of this one?
You got to tell
everybody. Everybody knows about that. Every business person knows about the decoy pricing strategy. So basically, you know, iPhone does this all the time. You know, you have an iPhone and it has 64 gigs and it costs, I don't know, $800. Then you have the same iPhone has 256 gigs and it's $900. And then there's one that's 512 gigs and it costs $1,200. It's a high price. People look at the high price one and they go, that's too expensive. Then they look at the low price one and they go, well, that doesn't have enough memory, but the next one's only $100 more. So I might as well get that. Now, they know that when they're selling their iPhones, they know that and they're predicting that model is going to be the highest seller because they've asymmetrically priced their products to sort of channel people here, that the expensive one is sometimes a decoy. You know, they know not many people are going to buy it, you know? So we did a similar strategy. We had a small, medium and large version of our software. And, you know, the medium was sort of $799 and the small was like $699 and the large was like $1,200. And we thought no one's going to buy the large, you know, they're just going to look at that and go, hey, guess what? $799 looks like a bargain. And, you know, the prediction was right. It was our biggest seller. You know, so there was no hard science in it. It was kind of like we chose something that we thought sounded reasonable and then put it live. And we had no idea if anyone was going to buy it, what the sales were going to be. You know, I mean, in my mind, I was hoping to make a few thousand a month. That's what I was hoping to do so I could pay the mortgage if things went south, you know?
I'll get to what you made in a moment, but when you say all you did was line chart, there was a market of people who needed just line chart and everything else they were going to do what with?
So imagine you're a lab technician and you have some kind of piece of hardware that's recording data. Usually that data is just lines and you want to see it. But all of the chart components that existed at the time, and even now, our reputation is the fastest in the world at what we do. You know, they can't display that much data. They'll just crash, they'll hang, the computer will slow down, use too much memory, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, there was a market for people who needed that, but they needed to display this data really, really fast. And the first version was pretty basic, but it was enough. I'll be honest, I was surprised myself.
Okay. First year sales was how much?
I believe we sold $173,000 in the first
173.
Year.
Did you celebrate any part of this?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was beyond beyond expectations. I mean, I told you at the time we were living in rented. We'd just moved to London. My wife had lost her job. And we were looking at the housing market in London. Where we had left, like, was half the price of where we'd gone. And we were looking at houses and we were like, how are we going to afford this? You know, we needed to come up with almost $100,000 deposit for a house.
Okay.
And you've got to earn that. That's post-tax income. So, you know, I really had to hustle to achieve that. So yeah, $173,000, it was way beyond expectations. I was surprised myself. And I was still working for that year and also for the next 1 or 2 years as well. So what I decided to do was kind of roll the profits, you know, back into the business.
Okay, into what?
Well, to grow it. I mean,
hiring, right?
Yeah, hiring, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I built this prototype in my first, in my spare time, but it needed maintenance. People were asking for features. They were saying, can you make it do this? Can you make it do that? Can you help me? Can you show me? It's a complex product. It needed a lot of, you know, expert assistance. And that took a lot of time. So the first thing I did when we got the first sort of month or two sales, I thought, right, well, we've made this much money. I can't remember the exact figure, but I think we made like, you know, $20,000 in the first 2 months. And I said, well, why don't I use that to hire? That's going to pay for, you know, a temporary worker for, you know, a few months and see what they can do, you know? And if the money keeps coming in, then we can keep paying them. So that was a decision I made early on, was to do that. The first guy I hired, he's still working for me, actually. He's been working for me for 8 years. Now. And
what was it about him? How did you know that he was going to be good? This was your first hire.
Yeah. I mean, obviously I'm a software developer myself, so it's easy for me to, you know, filter on technical skills, and you can have a look at their work. And, you know, what I do now is we tend to set coding tests, you know, face-to-face interview to determine, you know, their communication skills and so on and so forth. And yeah, he ticked all the boxes. So that was our first hire, worked out very well. And as the product grew, sales came in. He was maintaining it in the day. I would be like, you know, popping out at lunch and answering a few emails, or like, you know, telling him what to do in the morning and the evening. So I was still doing my morning, evening routine and working at the weekends and so on, but perhaps not quite as hectic as before. And, you know, we got to the point where we had to hire more because we needed more staff to build the things that people were asking for. So, you know, I looked at the amount of money that came in and I said, right, we've made this much money in the quarter. So I'm going to spend that. I'm not going to spend more than it. And then that's our budget.
So people.
Precisely. Yeah. So quarter by quarter, we looked at the money that came in and we said, right, I'm going to put this back into the business. And, you know, my own job was paying my own salary. So I had my own expenses paid. And yeah, that's kind of how we did it.
When did you quit your job? Why did you take so long to quit your job instead of saying, I'm going to hire myself?
Well, I was an expensive employee. At the time I was working in London. So by this time my career had really taken off and my income was, I was earning sort of £600 or £700 a day, which is about $1,000 a day. So, you know, $200,000 a year is a lot of income to replace. And you just don't know if, you know, the sales could stop tomorrow. A competitor could come along and swipe the rug out from under your feet, or, you know, a recession or I don't know, anything could go wrong. So I kept doing both for as long as I reasonably could. And it got to a point where, you know, I said to my wife, you know, I can't do this anymore. This is hard work. I need to quit. And she said, no, keep going as long as you can. Because
even though, you know, it meant that she was getting less of your time, your son was getting less of your time.
Yeah. By now she was seeing, look, this is really bearing fruit. You've got a shot here to do something. So, you know, she's been very, very encouraging the whole way, you know, with me on the whole journey, basically. And she said, you've got a shot to do something here. Go as long as you can. And eventually I just gave up. I said, look, I need to quit. And I went first part-time. My employer was very, very understanding. They allowed me to go 3 days a week because, you know, 2 days more a week was enough to get a lot more done. And eventually I quit. I quit in, I believe, October 2014. So 2.5 years after the first sale. And we'd done, you know, the first year we did $173,000 of sales. The second year was 300 and something. I can't remember the exact number. And the third year was, I think, close to $500,000. So by that time, you know, we had enough profit that would pay my salary. So yeah, that's when I quit to work on it full time.
How'd you guys have a good marriage, especially yeah. through this difficult period. How yeah. did you keep her connected to you? How did you stay involved with your son? I know how close you are with your son. frankly, I've been reading your Twitter account. That's how you and I really connected. I've stayed in touch through Twitter. And the most recent post that stood out for me is you teaching your son how to program and him sticking with it largely because, well, not largely, partially because he's getting a backpack. Am I right? He said to me,
I was taught how to do electronics by my own mom. She was a teacher at a school. She did design and technology, and she spent a lot of time teaching me. And that ultimately caused me to go into university, into engineering, and, you know, become the person that I am today. So, you know, I thought, well, I want to do this with my son. And I've tried to teach him to learn to code and whatnot. And he dabbled a little bit, but a little bit young. I think the first thing he did, he was maybe 7 or 8. But he said to me, oh, Dad, I really want this backpack. Look at this backpack. It's really cool. It's got like animated things on it. You use an app and you can make a little Pac-Man on this backpack, you know. And it costs about £200. And I said, that's an expensive backpack for a boy, you know. And he goes, oh, you know, I really want to, can I do chores? So we've been doing like chores, like he'll work in the garden and whatnot and, you know, earn money towards things that he wants. And I said to him, look, I'll set you a challenge. If you do an hour a day of learning to code over the summer, that's 60 days, 60 hours. I've got subscriptions to all of these websites with training materials. I'll tell you, I'll set the syllabus. You have to do an hour a day. You show me what you've done. I'll help you if you get stuck, but you're going to use these tutorials, right? And if you do that at the end, I'll buy you this. And you know, he's got this like spreadsheet. He's put all the numbers in and he's like, oh, I'm on track. I've done 32 hours. It's 30 days. You know, am I going to get it? And he's getting into it. And, you know, he started to enjoy it. I mean, you asked me the question of how did I maintain that connection? I mean, I'll tell you that one time when my son was say 2 or 3, maybe 3, I can't remember, you know, he was young. I came home from work exhausted and he goes to my wife, he goes, Mom, what are dads for? Right.
Ooh, yeah.
I mean, that cut me to the heart because, you know, as far as he could see, I was this freeloader that he didn't see. I came home and he didn't see me in the morning. I came home at like 7:30, 8 o'clock. I was exhausted. I was like, hi, son. I made a point that I would get home every day to do the bath time. Do you know what I mean? The bedtime story. I did that every single day. It wasn't a lot of time, maybe half an hour, but you know, many people, they work late, they work long hours. Many people have jobs where they have no choice. Many people have to have their children in childcare. My wife was a stay-at-home mom for, you know, those years. So she, you know, really brought him up. But I made a point that I was going to, you know, give him at least half an hour or 45 minutes or something, a quality time a day, which sounds like not a lot. But, you know, when I tell you the freedom I've bought from doing this, it has paid off.
What do you mean?
Hugely.
I'm saying, yeah, but I want to make sure that I understand. What is the freedom that you got now?
I have worked from home for myself for 6 years. I drive my son to school every morning. I talk to him in the car half an hour. I'm able to spend that time with him, ask him how his day is, what he's got planned, teach him things. I'm able to, you know, do stuff with him. We've been doing cycling, bicycling, you know, we've been learning coding, blah, blah, blah. You can't get that kind of freedom if you're commuting 90 minutes each way to work every day. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, it was tough. In the early years,
it really was an investment.
Yeah,
and it stinks. And if you're short-sighted and you say this is too much pain for my family, then you miss out on the benefit that comes later on for the rest of their lives.
Exactly. And I will be honest with you. I'll be honest with you. And some of your listeners might be surprised at this, that there were times when, you know, my wife would say to me, "You work too much. You know, why are you doing this? You know, it's putting a strain on this, that, and the other. I need to see more of you." And it was difficult. You know, I'm not gonna lie.
So then, how'd you get past that?
Well, I would say, look, I'm doing this for us. I'm doing this for us. This is what I want to do. This is where we're going. And I would try and like I don't know, like our family are treated like a unit, like a team. We're all on the same side, right? We're trying to get to the same place. We came from a place where we were broke. We had no money. We had no capital. We bought our first home because of this business. And then we grew. And, you know, I'm saying these are the possibilities. We're going to be able to pay for my son to go through college. We're going to be able to do this. We're going to be able to pay for that, you know. And I think that when I came home and working from home, that's really when, you know, the dividends started to pay.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
In terms of flexibility, income, freedom, and so on, you know?
So let's close it out with this then. One case study. We have a list of companies and organizations. NASA uses you guys too?
Yeah, NASA uses our software. I don't actually know what they're doing.
Let's go with the case study then of Formula One. There are tons of great companies, is what I'm trying to say. Tons of great organizations that we could have picked. I'm going to go with Formula One because you and I talked about it earlier.
Yeah.
What's Formula One doing with it?
Well, I mean, these are guys who need to visualize a huge amount of data. And they're also interested in speed, performance, because big data, if you're viewing big data on your computer, it uses a lot of CPU. It slows your computer down hugely. So we actually have 5 Formula One companies using our software. I won't tell you who, but major guys. And they're all building software that helps them tune cars during a race, before a race, after a race. So, you know, if you imagine a pit crew, there is a crew of people watching dashboards with loads of information while the car is racing or during a test lap or hot lap or anything like that. And they're looking at everything that's happening, the acceleration, the braking, the forces, the temperature on the tires, you know, anything you can think of. I think that we have a student team as well. They're a university team and they do not Formula One, but they do Formula E, which is Formula Electric. And they said, we send 300 sensors by radio from the car back to the pit. And then we display all this on the dashboard. They can see exactly what's going on. If something's failing, like a brake is getting too hot, they know about it. Do you know what I mean?
And they can watch the progression of heat on their chart and know, I'm imagining.
Exactly.
This is the direction we're going in. We need to do something about it.
Yeah. Absolutely. So they're able to say to the driver, hey, you know, your front right tire is getting too hot. You need to ease up on the brakes or, you know, or something like that. Or they can say to the pit crew, you know, you need to change your front 2 tires because they've burned out or the brake pads or this or that, you know, something's wrong with the car. Pull it in. Let's have a look at it. You know, I mean, these are really, really precise machines and they're displaying a huge amount of data. And they love our software because our software can display big data, it can display charts, graphs, but it can do it really, really fast. And that allows them to achieve their goals.
I'm so glad that you're here to do this interview. I hope you go out and do more and more interviews. You're somebody who when I was researching you, I found nothing. And you personally, I should say nothing.
I'm kind of unknown, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I found? I found like reviews.co.uk. There was a bunch of information about SciChart, your company. SciChart, like science chart, right? That's a combination.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah.
I hope you do more of it. Your blog post was so well done. Your storytelling here is phenomenal. There's just so much more that we could have touched on.
Yeah,
but I'm grateful to you for coming here. I know you're not a big interviewer, though I hope you will do more interviews. I appreciate you making this a place where you can be open and talk about your story.
Me too. I've enjoyed it. I mean, I'll be honest with you and say that until now, we've been 100% focused on the tech. You know, the tech was complex and difficult. And
customer service, from what I can see, apparently you guys are like super fast customer service. I saw one of your customers decided to test you and competitors to see who responded faster to email.
Hey, do you know what? I read this. I don't remember where I read it. If somebody sends you an inquiry to your business, how do I buy your products? Or can your product do this or that? If you answer within 15 minutes, you've pretty much blown the competition out of the water. That's it. Because they'll get it in their mind. Like they will have asked that question to 10 people. You know what I mean? And if you came back first, they're not even going to read what the other people have written. And the average response time, I don't know what it is on our dashboard, but I think for sales, it's like sub hour. And we aim to answer immediately if we can, but sometimes obviously, you know, life. But customer service, I will say that that's probably one of the reasons that we are successful is because we have not just made an excellent piece of software, but we've also tried to help people use it, shown them how to use it, coached them, solve their problems, and so on and so forth. It's a reputation that you know, we have an excellent reputation in this area. And it's paid dividends because people then go and recommend us to their colleagues and so on and so forth. We still get testimonies coming in. We get reviews coming in. As you saw, reviews.co.uk, there's about 300, 350 or so reviews for SciChart on there. And they're all saying the same thing. They're saying, this is excellent. The software is very fast. It's great. Customer service is great. You know what I mean?
Right. The company It's called SciChart. Check them out at SciChart.com. Am I right about that URL?
That's the one, yeah.
And I want to thank my two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first, if you're hiring developers, go to toptal.com/Mixergy. The second, if you don't like your hosting company or starting a new business and need a hosting company, go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. Thank you so much for doing this interview.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye, everyone.